I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Medical marijuana was legalized more than 2 years ago in Pennsylvania. The first dispensary opened earlier this year, and now there are 30 that have either opened or will be opening soon. Customers can choose from an array of pills, liquids, topicals, and now dry leaf. The Pennsylvania Department of Health has awarded 25 permits for cannabis growers, although none in Philadelphia. Earlier this summer, Governor Wolf signed a bill giving the green light to medical schools to team up with marijuana companies for pharmacological research. And Pennsylvania's Auditor General Eugene DePasquale has been pushing for recreational marijuana, saying it could mean millions, if not billions, in revenue for the Commonwealth. Well, today on Radio Times, an update on Pennsylvania and medical marijuana. We have three guests, all of whom join us by telephone. Steve Twett is a staff writer for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and he covers medical marijuana and addiction for the paper. Steve, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much, and good morning.
Good morning to you as well. Marcel Bond Miller is a psychologist, also an adjunct assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine, and he does medical marijuana research. Marcel Bond Miller, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And also with us, Shalon James, and she's a member of the Pennsylvania Medical Marijuana Advisory Board Patient Advocacy Subcommittee. Shalon James, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, you can join the conversation, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Steve, let me begin with you. I just want to get everyone on the same page here, especially for our listeners. So far, how many Pennsylvanians have signed up for medical marijuana?
The latest figures we've published had 30,000 patients, more than 30,000, who have been certified, and another 20,000 who have registered. That is, they've expressed interest in becoming participating in the program, but they have not yet gone through the certification process. So potentially 50,000 right now.
And there are something like 21 medical conditions. We can't do them all on the air, but what kinds of conditions would allow someone to have access to medical marijuana?
Well, some of them are pretty obvious. Seizure disorders, cancer, ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, Parkinson's, epilepsy, inflammatory bowel disease. Kind of the key one that was approved just this spring allows for use of medical marijuana for people who are trying to wean themselves from opioid addiction.
Interesting. And how about how many doctors have signed up to be part of this registry?
I don't know that number off the top of my head, but I've heard no indication that's a problem that has shown up in other states where doctors were reluctant to sign up to participate in the program, in part because they're required to go through like a 4-hour class, and in part, speaking privately to some physicians, they just don't want to become known as the marijuana doctor. But it's, the way the state has set it up, I think that there is enough interest right now that I'm not aware of any sort of logjam in terms of patients not being able to find physicians who will certify them.
Shalon James, let me turn to you. You are a member of the Medical Marijuana Advisory Board, the Patient Advocacy Subcommittee. What was your particular interest? And I have to say it was a very personal interest in your support of medical marijuana for your son.
Yes. So I became involved with the Medical Marijuana Board when I started to advocate for my son. My son has sickle cell disease, and it was one of the original 16 disorders that were indicated by the law. And so his sickle cell disease, and often with sickle cell patients, they are prescribed a high number of opioids in the treatment of their symptoms, which is often chronic pain.
Right.
Oftentimes when sickle cell patients go to the hospital and try to seek treatment and care, they're looked at as drug seekers. They have an extremely difficult time getting the medication that they need to just manage their everyday pain. And because sickle cell disease is not a disease that you can see with the eye, it is definitely a disease that works within the body. And so my son on a daily basis can look, fine, but he is coping with extreme amounts of pain. And so I really wanted to make this an option for him and for other individuals suffering with the disease, because I know how horrific it can be.
Well, let me ask you, I'm assuming he's now taking or using prescribed medical marijuana, and is he feeling better?
He is registered. He has felt better. His doctors are great. He goes to Penn State, Milton Hershey, and he has done a number of different things. Sickle cell disease is also one of those diseases that can affect people very differently.
Yeah.
And so the course of treatment will range. It'll be different for each individual. But for him, he has not had a crisis, what we would consider a pain crisis, in over 2 years. So there was a safe harbor process for him, because he is a juvenile, that he was able to do prior to the actual law being passed and us being able to get the medical marijuana in state. And he has not had a crisis in 2 years.
I want to get back to you, Shalom, but let me get you, Marcel Bon Miller, in on our conversation here. What kind of medical marijuana research do you do?
Well, most of my interest and primary focus is on post-traumatic stress disorder. So really trying to understand whether there are certain cannabinoids within the plant or elsewhere that's associated with improved symptoms among individuals with PTSD. So it's really important just to know that the plant has, you know, it's hard when we talk about quote-unquote medical marijuana or quote-unquote cannabis, is that this is a plant that, you know, is made up of hundreds of chemicals or molecules within it that have different effects, 120-plus cannabinoids, and they have very, very different effects. And depending on what ones are in there, you might have a completely different reaction. So really trying to drill down and understand differential effects on symptoms like PTSD.
Is it hard to do medical marijuana research? I mean, it is legalized in Pennsylvania, but it's also, as far as the federal government is concerned, it is an illegal drug, Marcel.
Correct. So this, you know, it being legalized in a given state doesn't really affect the research side of it, because the research side really falls under federal law. So it is a Schedule I substance. And so from a federal perspective, and when we do research and clinical trials, we have to follow those federal Schedule I laws. Yeah, exactly, within this. And so that means that, you know, there are only certain places that we can obtain the drug product, and there are also a lot of different hoops that one has to jump through to do the research. It makes it pretty difficult.
Steve, you had a story about a woman who was prescribed medical marijuana but also wanted to get Section 8 housing. It's a long story. If it's possible to summarize that, about how the federal government looks at medical marijuana and how a state like Pennsylvania looks at medical marijuana, how they can collide.
Yes, and so we're talking about someone who has gone through all the legal process of being certified and is now legally using medical marijuana under the state-approved program, but you have this conflict with federal laws, and she applied for a Section 8 voucher through HUD, the Housing and Urban Development, which is a federal agency, because it's a federally funded agency, and because of that, and under HUD's directions, they've had issued two memorandums saying, you should not allow admission or approve applications for people who are using marijuana.
Wow.
So she's running to that blockade, even though what she's doing is perfectly legal under state law.
Well, I wondered to you, Shalom James, if this came up at the advisory board and about this, I guess, collision of laws. Was that an issue?
It has come up a number of times with a number of different issues, and it's not something that we have much control over, because
right,
the laws are what the laws are. But we are very aware that they exist, that individuals are having difficulties when it comes to certain things. And we try to, if people reach out to the board or reach out to on the state website, we are in the process of setting up an avenue for people to voice those concerns so that we can bring them to the board and to the legislator and those kind of things so that we can try to help navigate some of those issues for folks as much as we can.
Marcel, I want to pick up on you talked about the complexity of marijuana, chemically speaking, about how you tease all that stuff out as a researcher.
Yeah, it's pretty difficult. Like I said, the plant has, you know, we can take cannabinoids as a group of substances within, or group of chemicals within the substance. There are 120 plus cannabinoids within the plant.
Right.
And primary one, the one that's responsible for, you know, an individual feeling high, that sort of euphoric effect, is THC. And most people know about THC, and that's really the primary one that's in there, most abundant within the plant. And most research is actually focused just on THC. 90-some-odd percent of research in cannabis at all has really just focused on THC. CBD, so cannabidiol, is the second most abundant in the plant, but it has a very different effect. It is not responsible for feeling high or anything like that, and it has almost opposite effects for a lot of things that for a lot of effects of THC. So, for example, THC, particularly in higher doses, can cause anxiety, lead to, you know, making somebody feel really anxious, whereas CBD, even in high doses, can actually make you less anxious, right? So they have very different effects. And like I said, THC can make you feel high, CBD does not. And so really trying to understand the balance of what's in what you're studying can be tricky when you're talking about the plant, because controlling levels of each of those different things can be quite onerous. And that's, again, we're just talking about two, but there are 120 plus in the plant. So, you know, stabilizing those, and really what it comes down to is most people just focus on THC and CBD and ignore the rest of it, hoping that it stays relatively stable over time, and just looking at balancing out levels of THC and CBD and seeing different effects.
We're almost having a break here, but broadly speaking, we talk about medical marijuana and recreational marijuana, and it sounds like, Marcel, that we need a much more complex way of talking about this.
Yeah, I think the distinction between medical and recreational is a tough one, because in reality, people appear to be using for lots of different reasons, and it's really, I think, it's pretty hard to find a pure medical or a pure recreational person, and even people that say that they use recreationally actually are using for some medicinal benefit one way or another.
Well, let's take that very short break. We'll get back to our conversation, getting an update on medical marijuana here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and that's Marcel Bonn-Miller. He's a psychologist, also an adjunct assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine, and he does medical marijuana research. Shalon James is a member of the Pennsylvania Medical Marijuana Advisory Board Patient Advocacy Subcommittee, telling us a bit about her involvement in this issue involving her son who has sickle cell. And Steve Twett is a staff writer for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette covering medical marijuana and addiction. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and just to recap, it's been more than 2 years since Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf legalized medical marijuana for patients with serious medical conditions. And on the show today, we're getting an update on access. We'll be talking about dispensaries, research, misconceptions, and the law. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Steve, let me go back to you. And interestingly, there were a lot of stories about the fact that dry leaf is now available. What is the big deal about dry leaf?
Well, it has a number of benefits for patients. First and foremost, that it's going to be cheaper because it doesn't need to be processed. But also there's a belief that the dosage can be better controlled and it will be more accessible for people. The financial part is probably the most important, because I know in the early days when the state only allowed the tinctures, pills, oils, and such, that patients were, and it was not unusual for them to be spending $200, $250 a month to get this medication. And with the dry flower, it's much more affordable.
In fact, there were some stories about a dispensary, I believe, outside of Philadelphia, where there were long lines there, people waiting for, essentially for hours in order to get dry leaf. Does that surprise you, Steve?
Not at all. The grower processors that I've spoken to say that even within weeks, the dry flower was represented almost 50% of their sales, almost right out of the blocks.
And do you know, see, why there are no growers in Philadelphia? I believe several were rejected. Several applications were rejected. This is a question hanging over the city here. Do you have the answer?
I don't, and frankly, the selection process has been kind of hidden behind the curtain, and there have been some efforts to find out more about how did the process work, who were the judges. The state has been very circumspect about that. I assume the motivation is that they don't want the people who are evaluating these applications to be unduly influenced. But because of that sort of secret veil over it, it raises questions like, why was this permit granted and this other one not?
And that's a bit mysterious at this point?
Yes, it is.
Shalon, can you shed some light on that?
I actually cannot. That process is something that I am not aware of. I know the general scope of the process, but that is not something that I even know who is on the committee or who makes the final say or what the outcome is going to be. We are just told as a committee how many have been selected, how many have been accepted, how many have applied, and those general statistics, but we don't have any idea of who's applying and how they are vetted.
Do you have concerns, though, about marginalized communities, whether communities of color or low-income communities or elderly people or disabled?
Oh, absolutely. So my biggest concern when it comes to advocacy for medical marijuana are those marginalized communities. We're talking about African-American communities, the elderly community, people of color in general, people that are disproportionately targeted by police, people that may perhaps live in country or rural areas where they don't have access to the typical internet services to be able to go online. And so we have started as a committee to talk about ways that we can bring some of those services to those individuals. When you go on to the website, it's user friendly, but it can be not user friendly if you are in a marginalized community or if you don't have the ability to access the information. So I'm always trumpeting the horn for individuals that are going to need the product but aren't going to be able to get the product the way that they need to be able to get it.
Marcel, let me turn to you. You've worked with veterans. Is that correct?
Yes. Yep.
Are they a marginalized community?
I think so. I mean, I think the veteran community is particularly tricky one within this space because of, what we talked about before is this juxtaposition between state and federal law. And that being that, a lot of veterans seek out medical treatment through the Department of Veterans Affairs. And the Department of Veterans Affairs is a federal agency and so is governed by those federal laws in this space. But the problem is that those hospitals are sitting within states, some of which have medical cannabis laws, right? So you might have an individual who is interested in accessing or learning more about cannabis, goes into their, physician at their, treatment provider at the VA, and that treatment provider, has to view this all as a Schedule I substance, can't recommend it, can't talk about it, honestly, much. And so that's you know, sort of the problem is that you have this discontinuity of care where you then have a veteran having to seek out cannabis from some third party or talk to a third party physician that isn't their primary treater just because their primary physicians within the VA can't recommend it or talk to them about the kind of the nuances in this space and what they should be using and things like that.
Steve,
so you have this.
Go ahead, Marcel. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying you have these two separate systems, so there's this just big disconnect, which can be really problematic from a healthcare perspective.
Well, Steve, let me go back to you, and you know, every state has come up with their own laws, their own regulation. I guess largely their own regulations. Is Pennsylvania grappling with this disconnect between Commonwealth laws and the federal government?
I think Pennsylvania, again, talking to the various permit recipients and even the applicants who weren't successful, across the board, they've been very laudatory about how the state has rolled out its program. Because we weren't the first to do it, I think that they'd learned some lessons from bad experiences in other states. If you look at a map of the U.S., the states in the eastern portion of the country have taken a much more conservative approach to it, and I know out west, in some cases, it was like the wild wild west in terms of you know, making up regulations as the program rolled out. So you know, I think that it is highly regulated. I think it's difficult in some ways to operate one of these businesses when you have to keep track of every transaction for 3 years, and you know, and the various other security requirements, deposits, and such like that. But overall, I think the rollout's gone remarkably well.
And we're talking about what, 30 dispensaries, or at least the green light for 30 dispensaries, Steve?
I think that's I believe that's the number, yes. And we are awaiting an announcement for the second round of dispensaries, which will come up sometime before the end of the year, is all I'm told. It may be that they're waiting for the recently permitted grower processors to get up and running, and so that we don't see the shortages that we saw earlier in the year.
Well, we are talking about Pennsylvania and medical marijuana with Steve Twett, and he's a staff writer for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Marcel Bon Miller is a psychologist, does medical marijuana research with the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. And Shalon James is a patient advocacy subcommittee member of the Pennsylvania Medical Marijuana Advisory Board. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Here's a question from Julia. I want to know where marijuana falls in terms of addiction health impacts in relation to alcohol and other drugs, with special attention paid to the effects on the teenage brain. A big question, Marcel, I want to toss that first to you. Do we know the answer to that?
So we know a decent amount about this, but again, this is where I become a stickler about what is marijuana, right? And that really we need to talk about these individual components of the plant, because, you know, addiction is a perfect example. So we know that THC is associated with addiction. People can, you know, develop dependence. They can experience withdrawal when they stop using it. They can build tolerance over time. They can crave it during times that they're not using it. So it's there. There is, you know, pretty well-established dependence potential for THC. And is it as strong as a lot of these other substances that were mentioned? No. But it's definitely real, and people experience it, and it can last for a decent amount of time. So for, you know, people using, you know, high amounts of THC who stop, they could experience withdrawal for over a month, month and a half,
wow,
even up to 2 months.
Wow.
With symptoms like aggression, irritability, problems with sleep, things like that. But it's important to know that, so that would apply, so I'll say that that would apply to, you know, cannabis that you buy that's, you know, which is typically what's sold in medical marijuana states, that has high amounts of THC relative to everything else in the plant. But CBD, so that cannabidiol, that second most abundant one in the plant, has a completely different profile when it comes to addiction. So, you know, they've you know, there have been studies more recently that have dosed people at quite high doses of CBD and really not seen much of any signal for those sorts of symptoms that I just talked about. So it really depends on what you're using here. You know, if you're using a, if you're using just straight CBD, really not much to worry about in terms of dependence at this point. But if you're using THC, that's a different story.
And Julie had a question about the teenage brain. Is there a quick response to that, Marcel?
Oh, yeah, sorry.
That's okay.
So the teenage brain, yeah, there's pretty convincing evidence to show, and this is, again, mostly linked to THC, that, you know, if you use in adolescence, it's really not a great thing, and that it could have long-term lasting impact because your brain is still developing during those adolescent years. So really, you know, avoiding it during that time, again, THC specifically, is probably a good thing.
Shalon, let me go back to you and go back to your son who is using medical marijuana for his sickle cell disease. Help us understand how that process works, how he gets it, how he uses it, how he feels, how he's able to function.
So I'm his caregiver, so I obtain the medical marijuana for him. And then depending on his doctor works very closely with us. So depending on what his symptoms are, he typically uses an oil or a topical to go directly on the area that is affecting him.
Where the pain is, it sounds like.
Right. Yes. So if he's having lower back pain, then a topical on the lower back tends to alleviate his symptoms, which is a lot better for him instead of ingesting 10 milligrams of morphine.
Right. Does he get relief? I mean, how long does it take before that pain begins to feel better?
For him, within 10 to 15 minutes, he can start to feel some relief and go throughout his day with no issues. When he was taking the morphine, that had an effect where he would take it, he would get some relief relatively quickly, but then he felt drugged all day. He had lightheadedness, he felt loopy, to the point where he would opt to not take the morphine or the other opioids that he was prescribed because he just didn't want the after effects of that medication.
Steve, let me go back to you. And I know that you cover addiction, and we also know that Pennsylvania, like just about every other state, is having a real crisis in opioid addiction. Is medical marijuana, is that now seen more and more as a way to address this problem?
Well, I think Pennsylvania was the first to approve that as a one of the qualifying medical conditions, that if you're trying to wean yourself from opioid abuse, that you can use medical marijuana products. And, you know, it's still in the early going, and maybe Marcel knows more about this than I do regarding the research. But, again, you go back to the conflicting federal and state laws. It's been hard to do these large studies, double-blind studies, when you can't get federal funding to do the research because the federal government considers it illegal.
Right. And this was – it's true now, and it was true in the Obama administration. Marcel, can you speak to that?
Yeah. So to correct a couple of misconceptions here and then
sure.
Talk a little bit about the conditions that are legalized in Pennsylvania and other states. So in terms of funding for, let's take opiate withdrawal or opiate addiction that was mentioned before, there is actually a great deal of funding for looking at cannabis in that space. So the National Institutes of Drug Abuse is, you know, really tasked with trying to sort out and come up with treatments and alternative approaches to addiction. And they have dumped a decent amount of money, particularly lately, into looking at cannabis and the, you know, potential cannabinoids and their interaction with opiates and really trying to sort this out. And so, you know, there is funding going into that area. And I think of all the areas from a federal funding perspective, I think the most of it is going into looking at those sorts of issues, looking at, you know, the potential for cannabis to help with certain addiction. But the reality is that, you know, the research on this stuff is, you know, far behind where it should be, and that's partially because, you know, it's difficult to do this research, less from the funding perspective in this particular area, but it's, you know, in lots of other areas, funding can be difficult. There are not that many cannabinoid researchers out there doing this work, and the hoops, like we talked about before, of doing research on a Schedule I drug can make the whole process pretty onerous. So that's, you know, really applied across the board in terms of why we know so little about cannabinoids in this space. So, you know, like was said, there are tons of different conditions that have been allowed in Pennsylvania for use of medical cannabis, but what we actually know about the use of cannabis in any of these conditions is pretty few and far between. So, you know, pick a condition, and, you know, we in a majority of them, we don't even have any clinical trial data in humans. You know, they're basing this stuff on anecdotal reports or rodent studies, and that's a big jump to, hey, everybody, you know, with this given condition in Pennsylvania can use it for this. There's some exceptions. Pediatric epilepsy is one, certain rare forms of pediatric epilepsy. We have a decent sense there have been some large clinical trials. But for other conditions, we really don't know a whole lot. And so it's a leap from a scientific standpoint to where we are right now.
Shalom, we have to say goodbye to you, and I want to thank you for joining us. And just tell us how your son is doing now.
He is doing well. He went from being homeschooled to now being a junior at local high school.
Oh, that's
he
great.
Attends full-time. So he is doing well. Thank you.
Well, I thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. That's Shalon James, and she's a member of the Pennsylvania Medical Marijuana Advisory Board Patient Advocacy Subcommittee. Steve Twett's staying with us for the rest of the hour. He's a staff writer for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and has been covering medical marijuana and addiction. And Marcel Bon Miller is a psychologist, also an adjunct assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine, and he does medical marijuana research. You can join us, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, and we're talking about the current state of medical marijuana in Pennsylvania. Let me get Jason from Allentown to join our conversation. And Jason, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. I have ulcerative colitis, and it's one of the qualifying conditions, also Crohn's disease. The reason I have not moved forward in getting a medical card is because my understanding is I would not be able to purchase a firearm in the state of Pennsylvania. And so that has just led me to stay within the black market of purchasing medical marijuana of a neighboring state.
Oh, interesting. Well, let me ask you, Jason, since you're on the air, you can say as much or as little as you want. How hard is that to access medical marijuana from a different state?
For me, not hard at all.
Meaning?
I mean, over the years, I've purchased medical marijuana on the black market for a long time. But recently, I've been able to get better quality stuff because it's now available through some neighboring states' medical marijuanas.
Well, that's interesting. Steve, can you respond? And is it true that if you're taking medical marijuana in Pennsylvania, you can't buy a firearm?
My understanding, and I haven't looked at this particular issue for a couple of months, so that may have changed. But my understanding is that the state police had set out a memorandum at one point saying that this would be an issue if for people who are applying for a gun license. However, current gun owners shouldn't have to worry about the police knocking on your front door and confiscating guns that are already in your possession.
And do we know about a black market in Pennsylvania? Do we know, Steve, about that? Does it exist?
A black market for marijuana?
For medical marijuana, yeah.
Well, the Auditor General's report estimated that there's close to 800,000 adults already using marijuana recreationally. So, in fact, that was kind of the basis for his pitch for perhaps legalizing it, because it would bring in, you know, something around more than $500 million in tax revenue. And I think this may be an ongoing issue for the state-approved dispensaries and even the grow processors, which is that given the set of regulations they have to meet, can they still price the product at a level where it's a good alternative for people who are, you know, have strapped financially and trying to consider whether, you know, whether it's going to be cheaper on the street or cheaper if I go to the dispensary.
Jason, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Marcia, let me go back to you. I know you did some research looking at online medical marijuana, and essentially that what people are being sold may not be what they are getting. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, so this study was actually on CBD, so cannabidiol. And, you know, a lot of people are using that for numbers of different conditions. And a lot of people are buying those products online. A lot of companies are shipping CBD across state lines. And so that's kind of, you know, for a lot of individuals, the easiest way to obtain it. The problem is that, you know, we found in the study, we bought essentially every single product that was available online, and, you know, sent it off to a testing facility, and were really vigilant about finding a testing facility that had really good methods and triplicate testing everything. And what we found is that 70% of those products that are out there, and it's important to note that, you know, while you can buy it online, these are also products that are available in dispensaries. We just chose to buy it online for this study.
Sure.
70% of them were mislabeled, and
wow,
we gave them plus or minus 10% of the content of CBD that was labeled on the bottle. So if it said, you know, this has 300 milligrams of CBD in it, we gave them plus or minus 10% to fall within as accurate, quote unquote. And 70% of them fell without, outside of that bracket. And, you know, a number of them had significantly less CBD than they said it did, and there were companies that had significantly more CBD. Beyond that, there were also lots of products that had THC, and some at decent levels, even though there was no labeling or indication at all that THC was in it. And that becomes a problem when, like we talked about before, you know, it can be dicey in terms of administering THC in adolescents. It can cause euphoria at higher levels. And even, you know, has addiction potential. And so, you know, when it's in there, I think from a consumer standpoint, it's, of course, really important to know that. And, you know, like I said, a bunch of products that were out there had it in, but didn't even say it, wasn't on the label, nothing.
Wow. Let me get Ian from Bucks County to join our conversation. And Ian, you're a CBD distributor. Is that correct, Ian?
Yes, Marty. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
I work in the area as a promoter, marketer, educator, and distributor of these products, and it seems that you folks are kind of touching on the topic that I wanted to mention. I think that the space is being heavily populated already by a lot of snake oil salesmen, and I think that third-party oversight is of utmost importance in the space. I could say from personal experience that we have a product that is already considered to be a little tenuous. And if somebody's grandmother's first experience with this stuff is a negative one, then that's going to reflect poorly on the potential for, you know, the science and the benefits overall.
Ian, do you have a dispensary? Is that why you're a CBD distributor?
No. I'm affiliated with a laboratory out of Oklahoma City called Cantech Labs.
Well, let me see. Marcel, seems like you and Ian are on the same page when it comes to oversight and regulation.
Yeah, I mean, the problem here is that because it's a Schedule I substance, and there's a lot of misconception here, CBD, when you buy CBD oil, that is Schedule I, according to the DEA. So this is a federally illegal substance. And The problem is that because of that, there is no oversight from the Food and Drug Administration. So, you know, an analogy I like to make is, you know, we know more about what's in a Hershey bar than we know about, you know, what people are taking as medicine, these CBD oils. And you know, while the FDA has oversight, you know, in terms of labeling, in terms of consistency and accuracy of products like Doritos, like Hershey bars, there is no oversight on this medical marijuana market broadly or these CBD products. And that's a huge problem. And then it's left to the states. But the states don't have the resources like the federal government has to oversee this. And so it's in a lot of states, it's a free-for-all. You know, imagine you can make a lot of money by selling CBD products and you have no oversight in terms of accuracy, content, labeling, anything. Right. And a lot of people are just, you know, there are good people out there that are doing it right just because they feel that that's the right thing to do. But like was said before, there are a lot of companies out there that are just going for it, getting as much money as they can in this space. And, you know, because there is no regulation.
Ian, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Steve, I wonder whether is the legislature looking at providing some more oversight? Do they see this as a problem?
I don't know that that's the case. I think we go back to this ongoing conflict between state and federal law, and there are so many ways that that can pop up. I mean, we mentioned the one patient with public housing, but it also affects the dispensary permit holders. We had one here locally who had scouted out a location during their application, thought it was a great find. The landlord agreed to have them, and then just as they were about to sign the papers, the bank stepped in and said, no, we can't do this. Banks are federally regulated too, and they just don't want anything to do with anything that that any business that handles marijuana.
Let me read a couple of comments. One from Mike. I have bipolar disorder and was smoking marijuana. Went to the doctors and they said marijuana is bad for people who smoke marijuana. I stopped smoking. Life has never been better. Also a question from Steven saying, mm-hmm. Can your expert speak to the use of medical marijuana to treat anxiety disorders? Marcel, that's something that you look at. Is it effective?
Yeah, so again, it's all about what kind of cannabis we're talking about. So if it's CBD, it appears that, you know, there's early evidence to show that it can be helpful for anxiety. But again, I underscore the fact that this is early evidence. There are no large clinical trials that have been done looking at the impact of CBD on anxiety. But some small studies, particularly in social anxiety, have shown, you know, CBD can appears to reduce those levels of social anxiety. You know, THC, on the other hand, and this is, again, you know, like I talked about before, THC can actually increase your anxiety. And so it's really important to know what it is you're taking and, you know, not just get medical marijuana, but really try to understand what's in it and really think about, you know, the differential effects as a function of what you get.
Marcel, do you think the public is more enthusiastic about medical marijuana than medical marijuana researchers? Like you?
Yeah, I mean, it's there's definitely of people that are, you know, gung-ho about this space and really getting into it. But the problem is that there's not a whole lot of concern for what the research says, which is really tough. And I think you're starting to see more and more people have adverse reactions because of it. So, you know, it's an ongoing problem.
Sure. Steve, is there an education component in Pennsylvania, part of this, the marijuana law, the medical marijuana law?
The individual dispensaries have all held open houses, you know, prior to them opening in the business, where they invited the public in. So, yes, and there are some private companies, Compassionate Certification, that also are set up exclusively to help counsel patients through the certification process. And then when they show up at the dispensary, they patients will meet with a pharmacist as well.
Interesting. Let me get Rebecca. Go ahead, Marcel. Go ahead.
Just one other thing about the education piece. So just a plug in that, you know, Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia and the Lambert Center within that has developed a continuing education course set that people can view. And a lot of experts from the field have gone in and have videos that you can watch to help you understand better, you know, the impact of, you know, not only the state laws of this, but also, you know, specific impact of cannabinoids on different conditions. And then there are also advocacy groups that have developed patient-facing materials, like Americans for Safe Access is one, that really, you know, has patient brochures and patient materials that can help with this education piece, because it's a really important one. So I definitely would say, you know, folks out there, you know, going to these resources that have these materials that are vetted and developed by experts is really a good thing.
Absolutely. Let me get Rebecca from Philadelphia to join us, and she is a medical doctor. Rebecca, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, Rebecca Morey. I have a cannabis consulting practice in Chestnut Hill, and I have so many things to say about this conversation, which has been wonderful. One is that I just am so grateful for the work of researchers like Marcel. You know, there's so much information that we still don't know, and there are so many conditions that are so well treated by cannabis, particularly migraines, which unfortunately is one that's not on the list in Pennsylvania right now, but I hope it eventually will be. I treat it as a chronic pain syndrome or neuropathic syndrome. But also, just with regard to
Do we have you?
I'm so sorry. I'm getting a call on the other line.
Go ahead. Rebecca, I'm going to move on, but I'm going to read something that you have here on the computer screen about the fact that you need a computer or email in order, I guess, to access medical marijuana or to get more information. And her concern, I'll put this to you, Steve, her concern is that older patients, you know, won't have the wherewithal, the skills to be able to access that information. Something actually that Shalon James had some concerns about these marginalized communities, and are they going to have the access and the information that the rest of us have?
I think that's a very legitimate concern. I mean, and particularly patients not only who are elderly, but perhaps in rural areas, and there may not be a lot of physicians around, and their longtime physician is not comfortable participating in this plan. Then in the program, they would be looking at traveling a long distance to go through this process, and it takes some initiative, and you have to have some background and to know exactly how to navigate all these steps.
Here's a question from Simon. I'll put this to you, Marcel. He says, would changing marijuana to a Schedule III drug help with research and legal issues, and how would that happen? But let me just put the first part to you. Do you think that would that solve some of the problems we've been talking about?
Yeah, I think, definitely rescheduling cannabis or even some of its components to lower schedules like Schedule 3 or Schedule 4 would definitely help from the research standpoint. Again, from a research standpoint, because it's Schedule 1, and just think about kind of this juxtaposition, if you're doing research on a Schedule 1, you need to store it in safes that are bolted to the floor with deadbolt locks on doors and have the researcher have a Schedule 1 license from the DEA. And this is for anything, even CBD oil, if you were studying that. So I think, you know, it's definitely onerous. It can be very expensive. And, you know, rescheduling it to something lower would definitely ease the research and would be great, honestly, from a research perspective.
Well, we're going to end on that note. And my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Marcel Bon Miller, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And learned a lot this hour of Radio Times. He's a psychologist, does medical marijuana research as an adjunct assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine. And Steve Twett, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thanks very much. I enjoyed it.
I did as well. And he's a staff writer for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, where he covers medical marijuana and addiction. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Sign up for our newsletter. Diana Martinez and and is our engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. I'm scrambling papers here as I'm closing out the show. Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern produce the show, and Mike Villers, our engineer, as well. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.